Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, talking recycling to begin the show today. Recycling is more than an environmentally good thing to do. It's also a big business. And today on the show, we'll learn more about the global industry with our guest, Adam Minter. He's a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. He's covered the global recycling industry for two decades. He's the author of two books. One, Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. And the other, Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. So we'll take your questions as we visit with Adam, and I hope you'll join in. What are you wondering about the recycling industry? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Adam Minter, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you've been on our network before, but never with us. So maybe you can talk about your own journey into covering the waste and recycling industries. How'd you end up here?
Well, I come from a long line of junk recyclers. My immigrant roots are in the early 20th century. My Russian forebears came over to the United States, didn't have an education, didn't speak English, didn't have any skills. So they started picking junk off the streets of Galveston, Texas. And that picking junk off the street, putting it in a backpack, eventually became a junkyard. And I grew up around that. Some of my earliest memories are being in the family junk warehouse. And I worked in it, doing things that, you know, if you took pictures of it and said I was, you know, living in South Asia, you might say it was a human rights violation. But eventually I left the business and became a documenter of it. And so for the last 20 years, I've more or less covered it almost full time.
Well, we've talked to local recycling experts in the past on the show, Adam, and we often get questions from listeners who are, shall we say, skeptical that their recycling is actually being recycled. Maybe you could talk about why people have been feeling that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, with any time there is what you would call a black box or a blue bin and you don't see where it goes, there's a natural especially in this sort of skeptical age, there's a natural tendency to be skeptical. Where does it go? And you add in some of the documentary, some of the news reports that we've seen, you know, dating back really till the late 1990s of how some of this stuff is exported to recycling facilities in developing countries that don't necessarily abide by American or European or Japanese health and safety standards. And if you're only getting a small part of the picture and that's the only documentary or news story you ever hear about recycling, I think it's natural to assume that's what's going on. And so I think a lot of the skepticism is related to, you know, it's not incorrect documentaries and news stories, but you know, not complete over the last 20 years.
Yeah, a lot of us think recycling is something to do for the environment.
Yep.
The industry, however, is more than that. Maybe talk about redefining our idea of recycling.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, most people in the United States, at least, and it's I'll talk about the United States and other rich countries, think of it as an environmental imperative. You know, we do it for the environment. It's a good thing for the environment. You put that thing in the bin and it's doing something good for the environment. But if you travel outside of wealthy countries, developed countries like the United States, it's an economic imperative and you do it for money. Recycling is for money. It can be the junk peddler like my great grandfather, you know, in Galveston, Texas, picking stuff up to sell, or it can be a very large automobile recycling operation outside of Milwaukee, say, that's recycling automobiles, not for the environment because it contains valuable raw materials. And one thing to keep in mind with recycling is it's the world's number two supplier of raw materials for all the things we buy, everything from your laptop to your automobile. You know, in the United States, 40% of the steel is recycled steel. You know, you've got, you know, somewhere in the range of 30% for plastic bottles and it goes on and on. So it's a huge business. I mean, you think about big business, you know, your recycled materials compete against virgin materials. So that's how I think of it. And that's how most of the world thinks about it. And that's what really makes recycling work. It's a giant business for supplying raw materials.
And I think most of us, or many of us, have the idea, and you sort of are hinting at this, you know, when we recycle something, it's often gets exported elsewhere for maybe for a different use. But could you give us a bit more of a picture about what the industry looks like?
Sure, sure. Well, if we're just talking about the United States, you know, the United States generates a lot of recyclables. And about two-thirds of the recycling that's generated in the United States, that is the stuff you put in your blue bin or drop off at a junkyard on your own, stays in the United States, and it's made into new stuff in the United States. But the United States is a fairly wasteful place, and so you've got that other third, and that other third needs to go somewhere, or it's going to end up in the landfill because there just aren't enough factories to make stuff from it, you know? And so during the 80s and 90s and 2000s, who was the largest manufacturer on the planet? It was China. And so naturally, recycling flows to people who want to use it to make new stuff. And so the United States has been exporting recycling since the 1880s. It became a big story in the 1980s and 1990s, and currently it exports recycling to over 100 countries, including Canada, which is one of the largest importers of U.S. recycling. So why do they import it? Because they want to make stuff from it. You know, if you put something in a recycling bin and nobody wants to make something from it, it's not recycling, it's trash. So one of the real challenges for the recycling industry is to find that company, that person who wants to make something from it.
I didn't know that about Canada. What does Canada use from us?
Steel, recycled steel, recycled aluminum. They are very advanced plastics recyclers, and that's a very quick growing area. So there's a lot of movement of different kinds of recyclables between, and the United States imports from Canada because there's different kinds of recyclables. When you start talking, you know, we think about the stuff that goes in our bin, but a big part of the recycling trade is industrial recyclables, stuff that's, you know, maybe used in factories and can't be reused in that factory. So maybe a factory in the United States wants that weird alloy and has the ability to process it, and somebody in Toronto doesn't.
Lance in Guadalajara, Mexico emailed to say he read a brief report about a project in the Philippines that's making usable house construction parts like lumber out of waste plastic bottles. He always thought this was possible. Wonders why aren't we doing it in the U.S., considering all the floods and windstorms, it might be better for home construction.
So I'm going to tell you how a recycling journalist thinks about that problem. You know, in the Philippines, you know, maybe they're, you know, they have a lot of excess bottles and they don't have other building materials. In the United States, we have a lot of other building materials. So it's a matter of business competition. Certainly we could do it, but is there a lower cost or more durable solution in the United States? And that waste management imperative, it's a great idea. I'm all for it. But, you know, somebody's got to say I can make money from it. And so that's why it's not happening here, and it's happening in somewhere like the Philippines.
Adam Minter, our guest columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, author of a couple of books, Junkyard Planet, Travels in the $2 Billion Trash Trade, and the second and newest, Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. What happened when to the industry? What's the industry been like maybe the last few decades? And then I'm wondering what happened to it when the pandemic hit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big story. But ultimately, the story of the recycling industry over the last two decades has been China. And when China became a major manufacturer, it needed raw materials, and it looked around the world. And it saw the United States with this huge excess of recyclables. And so traders began importing all those raw materials. We call them recyclables. They call them raw materials from the United States, and made them into new stuff, some of which was re-exported to the United States as new stuff. So that was the big story over the last 20 years. In fact, in China at one point, they were calling the U.S. the Saudi Arabia of scrap. Which is a really interesting term. It's funny, and it also gives you an idea of how China looked at these recyclables. This is not an environmental imperative. This is a raw material. China started to restrict the import of those recyclables in 2017. They announced they would, and that really sent the global, not just the U.S., the global recycling industry into a tailspin. China wanted to rely more on its own domestic recyclables. They didn't want to be reliant on importing anymore. The industry started to recover right before COVID, but COVID really gave the industry a kind of a good kick in the pants. Because there was just so much demand, especially in paper and cardboard, for packaging and other things that people were using at home. And so COVID has in many ways been very good for the recycling industry, especially the one focused on houses and residential areas.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit more about China.
Yeah.
So was there any politics involved with this, or...
No, it's interesting. You know, in China, I lived there for 12 years reporting on the industry there. And in China, the politics always comes later. People and business people tend to do what they want to do. And later on, the government decides if they want to regulate it. The politics behind the giant volumes of imported recycling in China were simply they didn't have enough raw materials for all these factories that people wanted to build. And so it was a relatively pain-free way to get raw materials. You know, if you're opening a factory in southern China, which is, sort of the makerspace to the world, you can do one of two things. You can go to the local mine or go to a mine in northern China and say, we'd like X amount of stuff. Well, you need political connections to do that. Or you can send somebody over to Madison who drives around to local recycling plants and says, I'll take a shipping container of that and I'll pay cash for it and I'll ship it back to China. And there you have your raw materials. And so that's really what drove it, was entrepreneurialism and the desire to manufacture in a low-cost way.
You know, I'm trying to wrap my head around the amount of materials and how it got there. I mean, do you have any idea on that?
Sure. Sure. Well, at one point, it depended on the year, but for most years in the 2000s and 90s, the highest volume, not value, but highest volume export from the United States to China was recyclables. And here's sort of one of the untold stories is, people are always like, well, it was so wasteful to send that stuff to China. Why wasn't it, sent here and you used all this carbon? Yeah. Well, not really, because at the time, and even today, China sends a lot of finished goods to the U.S. Americans like to buy Chinese goods, and Americans don't make much to send back to China. So in the 90s, there were all these empty containers, shipping containers, waiting to go back to China. What do you fill them with? And the shipping companies, they need them to be filled because they help balance out the ships. And so what do you fill them with? Well, there were some very smart entrepreneurs who figured out you could fill them with recyclables. And so, if you were shipping from Los Angeles at points during the 2000s, it would only cost in the range of $200 to $300 to send a 40-foot shipping container, those shipping boxes we all know, only $200 to $300 to send it back to China. But if you want to send it from China to the U.S., you're talking thousands of dollars. But that's how desperate China was to get those boxes back. And it was great. They came back with low cost recyclable raw material. So it was win-win for everybody. And depending on how you look at it, you could say that's almost a carbon-free means of transport because those containers are going back to China one way or another, like it or not, so why not send it back with sustainable raw materials?
Cyrus in Baraboo, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi guys.
What's on your mind?
Well, within the last couple of years, I pay attention to the environment, and I was watching a couple of documentaries, as Adam said.
Yeah.
And I watched one by Penn and Teller, and it's got a rather creative title, and I won't say it on the air, but they pointed out that when it comes to household recyclables, not so much on the industrial level, we can talk about that a little bit differently, but so far as household recyclables are concerned, that the amount of energy that goes into recycling the materials itself negates the environmental impact of the recycling of those items on a whole. The carbon footprint is not negated. It actually takes more resources and more energy to remanufacture, reprocess those things that have already been manufactured than it would just take to dump them into a landfill. Now, that doesn't solve space problems. It's more of a carbon thing. But when it also comes to true recycling, say you have glass bottles from beverage manufacturers. Those used to be washed, returned, paid a deposit on, you could bring them back. That's more true recycling in that regard. You're not wasting energy to recycle or it's actually upcycling, true recycling rather than.
Yeah, understood, Cyrus. Comment, Adam.
Yeah, let me give two comments. One on the bottle recycling. It's a really interesting point, and I was actually just reporting on this last week. I haven't published anything about it, but reusable bottles, glass bottles. Everybody wants reusable glass bottles like the old days. There is a problem, an environmental problem with reusable glass bottles. If they're going to be reusable, they need to be very thick. That means they're very heavy. That means you can only ship fewer of them and in a truck. And they require more energy to manufacture. And so if you do what's called the life cycle analysis on the reusables, as compared to the disposable glass, ones, you tend to find disposable glass ones have a lower carbon footprint. What I always tell people when you talk about recycling is this is not a black and white or a black and green issue. There's a lot of gray area here, and it's more complicated than recycling good, not recycling bad. In terms of the Penn and Teller documentary, I'm actually familiar with what he's talking about. And there is a grain of truth there, but it's only a grain. And here's the thing. The way recycling is handled in most parts of the United States is this. You throw it all into a single bin, and then it's left up to the recycling facility to separate all the stuff out of there. Some of the things in that bin can be recycled in a carbon-efficient way, in a economically efficient way. Aluminum cans, plastic water bottles. There's a huge carbon savings in recycling those, and there's a huge financial incentive to do it. Glass is much more difficult. It's not worth very much. It's very heavy, and so there's not much carbon efficiency. Then it depends where you are. If you're in a dense neighborhood like San Francisco, yeah, it's very easy for a recycling truck to go house to house. They're very dense. There's some apartments, and so it's very easy to pick up. But if you go, say, to Baraboo, which I've been to Baraboo, actually, the houses are far apart. And the amount of time that a truck can only pick up a small percentage of in an hour what it can in Baraboo than it can, say, in San Francisco. So it all is very regional, and it's hard to make a blanket statement like Penn and Teller have.
Adam Minter, our guest, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, as we talk with him about recycling and the recycling industry. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we visit about recycling and the recycling industry with our guest, Adam Minter, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Great to have him with us. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Kevin in Bellevue, Iowa, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, guys. Good to hear your voices on the air. A question in Poland. I'm concerned.
Oh, you're breaking up
about,
a bit.
Is this
you're
is
cutting
this any
out,
better?
Try again, Kevin.
So I've been checking into recycling when I'm in Central America and other places. Sometimes these products or like clothing tends to be baled and sent elsewhere, and they really it actually hurts their own textile industry. But more than that, it is so overwhelming they end up burying it in Haiti or other places because they can't even use it. And so, and as far as the Philippines using plastic or whatever, I wonder if their labor standards or their environmental standards are hardy enough to protect the people that live there. And so that's why some of this stuff is used elsewhere that can't be used in the United States.
Adam?
Yeah, well, let me take the second part first. As I said earlier, and whenever I talk about recycling, I say this, recycling follows manufacturing. Manufacturers need raw materials. Those manufacturers may not always meet the health and safety standards, that we have in North America or in Europe or Japan or Australia. And so neither will the health and safety standards for the recycling industries that exist there. It's not a simple issue, and it's very hard to parse them out. But so long as consumers depend upon manufacturing in places that have lower health and safety standards, they will, to an extent, also rely upon recycling in places that have lower health and safety standards. So it goes together. In terms of the textile question, the clothing question, it's a very interesting question about the export of clothing. I'd like to flip it. I always say that the clothing is imported because nobody's just sending something for free unless it's a charity, and very few and even the charities sell the clothes. But recycling isn't exported, it's imported. Somebody pays for it because they have an intention for it. They even pay for the donated stuff. What is the intention? The intention is to give it, or more often than not, sell it to consumers on the ground. Inevitably, some of the clothing in these bales that you see in a place like Central America is not going to be wanted by somebody. Not every garment is going to be wanted. And so you will have some waste. But I think it's very important to keep in mind that that stuff doesn't move if there isn't an importer who wants to bring it there. Nobody imports, you know, thousands of dollars of cargo just to bury it in a hole. Their intention, at least, is to sell it.
Mm. Good points. And again, Kevin, thank you. Pat in River West, I'm sorry, in Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got in a little late, but I grew up with parents that grew up during the Depression. So the recycling was more out of economy, but you become a naturalist or a environmentalist by conserving. In the whole pop bottle thing, the numbers that these bottles would be too heavy, you know, the other glass has to get off the property. So a big garbage truck comes and hauls the other glass away. Like, that glass doesn't disappear. So I just can't believe the numbers of glass being a little thicker would discount the whole idea that you recycle that bottle 100 times or 1,000, and, you know, plastic.
Yeah, gotcha.
Oh, it's a great question, and I share your skepticism. I mean, I really needed to see the numbers, and I wish I'd actually brought them. I was literally reporting on some of these issues last week, and I'm going to be publishing on it soon. But the logistics are very interesting, and it's amazing the companies out there, how they will try to save on their shipping costs. And of course, shipping is a big topic right now. But for example, let's move to aluminum instead of glass. Over the last 30 years, the number of cans that you can to a pound, aluminum cans, like a Coke can, has actually increased. I can't remember what it is, but I think you get three more cans per pound than you did 30 years ago. For a company like Coca-Cola, for a company like Budweiser, that is millions of dollars in savings. It's not just that it's light, it's not just that it's lighter, but you can actually fit more on a trailer because there's weight limits on trailers. And when you can do more, when you can fit more of a product onto a logistics platform like a trailer, that means that you're saving on carbon emissions. The heavier bottles, and this has been looked at by all kinds of different companies, and I can't name the ones until I publish. But again, the thicker bottle, you need a thicker bottle because it doesn't break. And those thicker bottles weigh a lot more, and it means you cannot move as much product. So say you can only move 5 bottles of Coke. I'm just throwing this out there, instead of 10. Well, that means you need to run 2 trucks. So that's where it all comes in. So it's a very, very complicated problem. And it's somewhat dependent upon location. Maybe it works in a dense place like Brooklyn, but it won't work in a less dense place like Eau Claire. So these are really hard questions. And you know, I think we all want there to be the black and white, black and green solution, but it's going to be location dependent. It's going to be very gray.
Pat, thanks again. Appreciate it. Louie in Oconto, on to you now. Hi, Louie.
Yes, I have a question about the plastics. I've heard that a lot of plastic, like 10%, is actually reused or recycled. And, of course, we have all those different numbers, 1, 2, that type of thing. Are the water bottles that you buy at the grocery store, and I see people buying cases of them, are they actually virgin plastic, or can they be reused to make new water bottles? And of course, the plastic is made of petroleum products.
Yeah.
My second point is just to throw out there that maybe we should use aluminum, which is maybe recycled more. And also, people demand less plastic as a consumer.
Hmm.
Right. I'll take the first one, the PET bottle. is what it's called, the water bottles. And those are highly, highly recyclable. And there's a very strong market for them, and it goes up a lot. The ones you get at the supermarket are food grade. So that's almost always in the United States a virgin bottle. Because people are going to be eating and drinking from it. What happens to them? There is such a thing as bottle-to-bottle recycling, but there's a market for that kind of bottle. Carpet makers like it. Oh. You have electronics manufacturers like it. PET is used in electronics all the time. I know Dell Computer is a major buyer of PET bottles. They use them in their products. So that's very exciting. And as a result, one of the complaints you get from companies that like to use PET for various things like carpeting is they can't get enough. It's highly recyclable, but people don't tend to put them in their recycling bin, or they put them into the recycling bin and the local recycler may not have the technology to separate them out. So the real challenge is let's get more of those into the proper bins because there's huge demand for them, and they can go bottle to bottle, but it's a little trickier because it is food grade. The second question was what I totally forgot.
Let's see, how much of the waste is actually reused?
Oh yeah. It all depends where you are. The data point, 10%, comes from a very famous paper in Science that is receiving some criticism recently, and there's a lot of skepticism about whether it is as low as 10%. I'm one of the skeptics. I mean, when I was in China reporting on this, I saw the plastic recycling rate much higher, depending on what the kind of plastic was. But there's no question that we don't recycle the majority of plastics. The good news is that we are now in the recycling industry at a period of innovation unlike any in the last really 40 years. There's huge amounts of research going into plastics recycling, investments in it, and I think in the next 5 years we're going to see that rate increase a lot.
Yeah. There we go, Louis. Thank you for calling. Frederick in Minnesota, your turn.
Yes, hello. I used to work for a recycling company, which recycled plastic bottles, tin, and aluminum, and all that glass. But they were throwing the electronics, all the electronics they came in the dumpster, which is in this state illegal. But they would not listen to me and get it out of there. And it was not enforced, and all no one came around and told them they couldn't do it. But I'm started my own recycling company. Well, it's not really very big, but I'm trying to recycle the batteries. When the batteries come in to work where I used to work, they send them over to me now, and I charge them up with a battery charger I bought online. And the ones that don't recycle, the ones that I can't recharge, I put in a box called it's for Call to Recycle. It's the name of the company. And they recycle them. I send them off work. It costs $45 for 25-pound batteries, but I can do that and charge the other batteries instead of throwing the batteries in the dumpster, which are recyclable. You know, you can recycle batteries, so.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll just say Call to Recycle is a great operation. They do battery recycling, not just for individuals, but for very, very large companies that we've all heard of nationwide. And the electronic scrap, the e-waste, however you want to call it, that situation has improved considerably, in no small part because we all hear about the semiconductor shortage right now. There's a huge emphasis on getting that stuff out of the dumpsters, and some of those parts can be used for repairs as we now lack new semiconductors. People are really pushing reuse of electronics. So the situation is much better than it used to be.
Yeah. And by the way, we'll be talking about batteries and light bulbs and sustainability relating to them in about 10 minutes here on the show. So stay listening on that, Frederick. Tony in Egg Harbor will give you a chance. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I had ordered a bunch of cabinet-style toolboxes recently, and when they came in, the amount of styrofoam that was molded styrofoam in these boxes was obscene, and it filled a pickup truck just to bring them to the dump. What does the guest think about putting the squeeze on the manufacturer to pay a disposal fee based upon their output And if they come up with more creative, recyclable and biodegradable materials, that they could avoid that tax.
Hmm.
Well, I think it's an interesting question. What the caller is referring to, and I think he probably knows this, is something called an EPR, an Extended Producer Responsibility System, which several U.S. states are looking at right now. I think two have adopted it, which is the idea that the producer of a product or a packaging is ultimately responsible for the disposal of it, or at least paying somebody to dispose of it. I'm sympathetic to the idea. I wouldn't say that I necessarily would sign on quite yet. I worry that some of these systems may inhibit innovation in the space. And there's been some evidence in Canada, which has been trying EPR, and in Europe, that what ends up happening when you require the producers to do it is they say, well, look, it's cheaper for us just to keep paying this fee instead of innovating some new kinds of packaging. I think right now the most powerful incentive out there to really change how manufacturers are producing packaging is simply consumer sentiment. Things have changed with ocean plastics. People are much more environmentally conscious, and you see manufacturers panicking. And how much more do we see now, you know, in the store, you know, this is made from recycled packaging. Or I was at a Costco the other day and I could see the packaging is smaller than it used to be for certain kinds of products. So the and we also see manufacturers saying committing, and it's changing the recycling markets, committing to using recyclable materials within their products. So that consumer sentiment is really changing things very rapidly right now. It's one of the things that's driving up the prices of recycling and helping out municipalities all over the United States. They can sell their recycling more. I kind of like to see how this plays out right now. But I'm certainly sympathetic to the sentiment. I'm just not, for me personally, as an opinion writer even, I'm just not quite where I'm ready to commit to an EPR yet.
Okay. Thanks, Tony. Maureen in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I split my time between Madison, Wisconsin, and Jakarta, Indonesia, where we have a lot of imported plastics coming through. You mentioned about when there are plastics being shipped overseas, there's actually, that means there's demand overseas of those recyclables. But what's also really happened, especially in Indonesia, when they say they're going to ship recyclables, they also stuff in other things that it just cannot be recycled. We find that I shouldn't be talking on behalf of other people or the whole country. I find that appalling how, you know, when you want to import something, you're buying recyclables, but then the sellers, which, you know, mostly coming from the developed countries, the U.S., Canada, they're stuffing other things that just cannot be recycled. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a great call, and you're absolutely right. And this is a longstanding problem in the recycling industry, globalized recycling, dating back really to the 1880s. You can find accounts in newspapers and trade journals that far back of sort of unscrupulous recyclers getting an order for one kind of product and putting something else in it. Years ago, I was in a very large paper mill in southern China, where they would import very good cardboard from the United States. And most of the people they imported from would send them good, clean cardboard. But they then pulled out a photo album. In those days, it was still photo albums, and showed me a shipment of cardboard that had been accompanied by a dead horse. Now, that's a very extreme example. But I think, you know, if you are somebody who's familiar with the situation in Indonesia, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, the good news is that there has been some progress on this issue. Indonesia is setting up basically what amounts to a kind of licensing regime where exporters have to notify what's coming in ahead of time, and the importers you know, also have to certify it. So you're not bringing in garbage. Will it fix everything? No. I will say this, though, having been around this industry for many years, you know, somebody who imports a dead horse and cardboard from a company in the United States isn't going to do business with that company again. And one of the things you find in emerging market countries like Indonesia, they are not fools. You know, they are business people and they want to import good stuff. And if they get burnt by somebody, they're not going to go back. And so over time, markets can correct this. But obviously, incorrect some of it, but obviously over time there needs to be better communication and some regulatory effort on the part of exporters to make sure that they're not frankly cheating the importers in emerging markets.
Thanks again, Maureen. Jeff in De Pere, hi.
Hey, good morning. I've been listening, and I think it's a great topic. I've worked for some big box stores and some manufacturers in the state of Wisconsin since 2014. They recycle steel. They recycle cardboard. They don't care about plastic, especially plastic wrap. It starts with the corporations. You don't have to tax them more. Just help them find somebody to take the plastic. The company should help to find somebody to do that. They have environmentalists. They don't want to dump paint. They don't want to dump chemicals. They ask certain questions. But plastic goes by, or a toaster goes in the landfill, or a garbage can goes in the landfill because it's returned. The vendor gets paid for that.
Comment, Adam?
Well, you know, he's right that plastics is hard and it's expensive and it's a money loser for a lot of companies, you know, large distribution companies. They want to sell the recycling. They want to get it out the door and they'd like to at least reduce some of their costs. You know, in terms of the plastics, I mean, the wraps you're talking about, those are called thin plastic films. There aren't right now good recycling options for those. There may not be for a while. Eventually there will be, because in my experience and just my own reporting, you're seeing the consumer brands realize that they have to do something about this. So I'm optimistic, but I should say this as we're sort of getting close to the end here. You know, recycling will not solve all of our ills. And, you know, I think some people treat it as, and I say this in the first book, as a get out of jail free card. Oh, I put it in the recycling bin. You know, the sin of my consumption has been, waived. And I can now go on buying and doing whatever I want to. It doesn't work that way. And ultimately, it does come down to how we consume, what we buy. And certainly corporations that make these products bear some responsibility. I also believe there is individual responsibility rethinking how we shop. You know, is shopping going to be our only form of entertainment? If you shop for entertainment, you're going to have an environmental impact, and no amount of tossing things into the recycling bin is going to take away that impact. So I encourage people to think in those terms as well. It should not be the only solution. It's just one.
Ann in Manitowoc emailed to say thanks to me for having you on the show, Adam. Oh. Her book club read secondhand. She said so many fascinating stories. And wondering if you would just comment maybe briefly on the clothes, cloth rags chain of recycled books and other household items in Japan.
Japan is a very interesting example. There's a high degree of reuse in that country, and they import a lot of clothing from the United States. There are people who travel the United States going thrift store to thrift store, Japanese buyers, who send that stuff back, and it's sold as vintage clothing, stuff that we necessarily wouldn't necessarily buy. I remember going into vintage shops in very expensive neighborhoods in Tokyo and seeing, you know, torn T-shirts, maybe a University of Wisconsin one from 20 years ago, and they're selling it for $60. It's an interesting, but people value things differently. At the same time, you know, you could go just up the street and there'd be a used kimono market, and the only people buying those used kimonos are Americans, because if you ask the Japanese, they say, "I've got a closet full of these things." So it's quite interesting.
Oh, Adam, this has been great fun and interesting. I learned a lot. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Really appreciate
your
time.
Thank you. I'd love to.
Adam Minter, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and he has two books. One, Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. The other, Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And as you just heard from Ann in Manitowoc, they really love secondhand and probably love either one of those books. So great to have him with us. We'll try to get him back again. And we're going to continue talking about sustainability in a way. We'll look at batteries and light bulbs. What's going on with batteries and light bulbs? I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.